This is Behind the Pixels.
Welcome to Behind the Pixels, the podcast that's all about the people behind the avatars. In this episode, we're going to be listening to Christian Payne. Online, Christian is Documentally, and he describes himself as a freelance mobile media maker who also specializes in social technology and connected platforms. Now, Christian is a former shepherd. He also used to be a full-time professional photographer. But he's evolved, he's moved on, and these days he's an online storyteller using audio, video, photography and words. Importantly, he also helps other people tell their stories as well.
Hello, my name is Documentally. The name Documentally initially came around in one way because documentary.com had gone, and because I had a large audience in Japan at the time, I think I was having a joke with one of the guys online one day, and you pronounce documentary documentally. And so it kind of fit, and I created the tagline, mentally documenting the mind, and that was initially what I would record. And some of my early documentally.com recordings, I would have mentally documenting the mind. I mean, it means nothing other than, you know, I'm trying to get inside people's heads and find out how they work. I call myself a blogger and not a journalist for lots of reasons. I'm not a journalist is one of them. I have a press card, but it says photographer quite clearly on it. I say I'm a blogger, you know, and if I could have on my press card, you know, gonzo, I would have the word gonzo. I'm a big fan of the, I guess Hunter S. Thompson has been attributed with the genre of the putting yourself into the story. And the reason for that is a lot of the stories I connect with are because I have a rapport with the storyteller. A lot of the news I connect with is when the reporter has forgotten they're meant to be completely sitting on the fence and unopinionated about this, but is quite emotionally moved by what is happening around them. How can you not connect to that? This is how we have shared news for thousands of years. I'm not saying there's no place for proper journalism. I'll call it proper journalism because that's what people like to call it. There's more of a place for trained journalists now than ever before because they set the datum. They lead by example. They show how you need to ensure you check your sources and check the facts again and again and again, especially in this time when everything's moving so fast and it's very easy for the wrong message to get millions and millions of views. But for me, I'm having fun and I want to share the personal journey. I want to share my personal experience, get inside the story. And so when I say this makes me feel like this, you can connect with it more because it might make you feel the same way as well. I'm not sure if I've told the story of how I became a shepherd before, not online. I was in Laos and I had really bad stomach ache, as you would imagine, travelling around Southeast Asia. And somebody told me, you know what the locals do for stomach ache? In fact, you know what they do for pretty much everything? They go to the opium den. So, as is normal, like going to a coffee shop is over here, I went to the opium den in Laos. And being the kind of person that's very, very susceptible to all types of drugs, including the ones you can buy over the counter in the UK, I tentatively entered and, should we say, self-medicated. The experience itself was quite incredible. You're lying on a mattress on what could be today, what could be the 1800s, and there's other people lying around you, locals and travellers alike. And there was this, I won't say wizened because it makes him sound older than he actually was, but he definitely looked like he'd lived a bit. A German gentleman, Swiss German, lying on a mattress kind of next to me in this room. And we're both staring at the ceiling and having whatever visions you have when you are self-medicating in this way. And I said, "What do you do?" He says, "I'm a shepherd." And I said, "Wow, I've always wanted to be a shepherd." And he said, he just turned to me and says, "Are you serious?" I said, "Yeah." And he took out a notebook and he wrote down He wrote down a latitude and a longitude and a time and a date. And he said, if you're serious, meet me here at this time and I'll teach you how to be a shepherd. And I thought, well, I can't be that much to it because I was brought up on farms mostly. So it was, I think, almost a year later, having had a go at rejoining society, when I was going through some of my travel journals and this bit of paper fell out. And I thought, OK, I'll give it a go. And it kind of meant that I travelled into Switzerland, and then I travelled to the end of a train line and then the end of a bus line. And then I had to take a cable car up a mountain and just keep walking. I had a Garmin GPS that was just kind of saying this way. And 6 hours later, I came to the brow of a hill and he was standing there with his Bergamasco sheepdog sat next to him, waiting for me. And I must tell you, I was a little bit freaked out because I thought, how on earth did he really think I was going to be here? And I guess I was half an hour late or so, which I don't think is too bad with a year lead time. And for the next 2 days, he showed me, it was kind of slightly misleading because he was a cow herder, but pastore translates to shepherd. So I kept calling myself a shepherd, but it was 37 head of cows that had to slowly be moved up the valley. And this is in the Ticino area of Switzerland. Devastatingly beautiful, and it felt like it was all my own. After 2 days, he buggered off and went to sell piercings that he'd bought in Southeast Asia. He did this every year, but he'd normally do it after the cows had been looked after. Now he got the chance for me to babysit while he went on his selling spree. And I took the wages, which were quite substantial considering there were no shops. And whilst living in the mountains, I was there's three houses you move up, lower, middle and higher in the valley. And on the lower valley house, I would lower a barrel 1,000 foot down a cliff to a village. And my shopping list was in there and they would fill it with stuff. And then I'd start this old VW engine and pull the barrel back to the top. I would use that barrel system for the middle house. But when it come to the top, my isolation was broken once every 2 weeks, where a helicopter pilot who would serve a number of different hippies and vagabonds and travellers like myself who had been roped into this weird job, by dropping a big delivery initially, which contained a mattress because you're above the snow line, your mattress had normally rotted away in these little stone huts, and then big wheels of cheese and vats of wine and all the grains and pulses you needed to kind of see you through. And you supplemented all of that with wild mushrooms, which I'd learned to forage. And I hate to say it, it's still possibly the best job I've ever had, even though I love everything I do right now. The most fascinating thing was learning what the cows are doing from a distance. And I'd quite often just sit on a rock and look across the valley, eating my bread and cheese from my little satchel with my dog next to me. And I could tell by what the cowbells were doing. These are Swiss Browns, those beautiful looking cows off the chocolate advert. And when they were walking, there'd be a clank, a clank, a clank, a clanker. When they were eating, there was a much shallower kind of tinkle as they were bending over eating. When they were running, it would be a much more rhythmic clanking. And then if you ever heard a clank, clank, silence. Clank, clank, silence. It meant they were rolling down the hill and probably needed some help. When I was on my own in the mountains, there was still a lot of communication, whether it be with the cowbells, with the dog, an internal dialogue, which in some ways got a little bit out of hand. But also, and trying not to sound too hippie-ish here, but this kind of communing with nature as such, and understanding messages and signs around you. And I guess that's why I still keep a connection with it through, when I get the chance, doing bushcraft and things like that. And it's, communication is the key here. It's not necessarily about people in itself. It's about sharing ideas and sharing knowledge. And I think that when I decided to settle down, which was 1999, it came to me that I needed to work in an environment where I was communicating with people and I was sharing stories. For the 10 years prior, I'd taken my retirement. I had been travelling 56 odd countries, and one of the threads that carried me through all of this was stories, was communicating, was getting the news from the person on the path coming the other way. And so in many ways, I think it was a natural progression, being social. Social media is just another tool enabling you to curate and share. So for me, it was saying I was a photographer. Before I was actually a photographer, I walked into a newspaper and said, I'm a photographer. And I had very, very little experience. In fact, it was one of the last days travelling in Thailand where I just bought an old Nikon EM, the closest thing I could find to a manual camera, because someone said, if you want to learn photography, you need a manual camera. And I bought this camera and then woke up in the middle of the night. I had ASA 200 filming and the hotel I was in was on fire. And I thought, oh, no, one thing I know, that if you're photographing at night, you need at least 400. So I leave the hotel and I'm standing in the street and there's a little boy dressed in a fireman's uniform and with, you know, this huge coat and bare feet, standing in a puddle holding a hose. And I thought, is the hotel on fire? Am I actually dreaming this right now? And because I was inside the cordon, because I was inside the hotel that was burning, it was actually the building next door that burnt and caught the hotel, I took some photographs. Not many turned out, but the one of the little boy looking at me, standing in this puddle holding this hose, did. And just before my flight, I had a chance to get them printed, because I thought it's going to be cheaper to do it here. And these photo booths kind of show the world outside, the images as they roll off. And somebody saw that image, came in and bought it for an in-flight magazine at quite a hefty price. And in many ways, I could have travelled for another 6 months if I'd wanted to. And I did extend my travel, but not quite so long. And I thought, wow, this makes me a photographer. I've sold an image, which has enabled me to live. So it was easy for me to walk in with a false confidence to the Leamington Observer and say, I'm a photographer. And easy for them to say, thank you very much, we'll put your form on the list. About 3 months after I joined the locals, I was spotted working in an unusual manner, jumping across canal boats, and got a job with the dailies. It was 2 years later when I left the dailies to go freelance, they realised I didn't have a qualification in journalism or photography, which bothered them a little bit, but I guess showed that you don't necessarily need the skills if you can, you know, confidently do the right thing. And I was taking photographs and telling stories. I'd got so disillusioned, though, with how news was working and how many different people my photograph and my picture caption had to go through before it actually got into the newspaper. And then when it got into the newspaper, you realised it was just balancing out an advert on the other page and nobody really cared. And that's what made me go freelance. Little did I know, freelance meant large comedy checks and a lot of handshakes before anything exciting happens. The more people were picking up cameras and saying I'm a photographer, the more clients I could go around and they could say, could you teach us how to use this camera? And then I would finish the sentence with, so you don't have to hire me again. the more I realised I needed to diversify. And so when I'd go and photograph a dress rehearsal at the theatre, I would take a flip style camera, one of the early ones, with me, and I would get a 1 minute interview with the director, tell me what this production is about in 5 words, and then I would upload that as a bonus. And that kind of enabled me to, I think, be a photographer for a little while longer, using platforms like Flickr, which in many ways, every time you upload a photograph to Flickr, you're creating a blog page where someone could comment and share and embed. For me, that enabled the client a lot more, because I was saying to them, these images are yours to do with what you will. I still kind of share the license, but I'm giving you a lot more freedom than another person who might say, no, you pay per use. And we can see how ridiculous this is now. And I kind of guessed it was ridiculous back then. I saw how many clients were using these images, sticking them on a CD, throw them in a drawer, then forgetting about them. I didn't have to worry about my pension and such like. So for me, the biggest turn came in 2005, when I was shouting at the television and I didn't believe what was going on in the news. And I thought, right, I'll take a couple of weeks off and I'll go to Iraq. Suddenly realised that I couldn't actually fly into Iraq because the war was on. So I flew to Turkey, hooked up with a friend of mine, a journalist friend of mine, who was going to do the writing and I was going to do the images. And we went over into northern Iraq, and recorded, I think, some amazing stories, of which of only a few kind of came out. Only a few photographs were printed, three maybe, The Guardian, The Times, The Telegraph, and I thought, 50 quid a pop, it's hardly worth risking my life. Somebody said, 2005, why don't you use this new tool called YouTube? And I'm thinking, okay, well, how's this going to help me? You know, I'm a photographer, I don't do video. They said, no, you know, talk over the top, add some music, your photos are now a video, it's like magic. And I did that, and I suddenly realised that just by looking at the views, that more people were likely to see my photography in this way, and more people were looking at my story that I recorded in Iraq in 1 week than would have seen in all of the daily newspapers in a month. And I could not ignore the impact. I could not ignore the ease of sharing that a platform like YouTube suddenly enabled. It might have helped that mostly it was just cats on there at the time. What was a real eye-opener for me as a photographer was the fact that everybody in photography at the time saw every photograph they took as a little potential ticket to wealth, or a ticket to fame, or a ticket to an exhibition, or a ticket to this. And for me, I thought, well, everybody is now selling photographs and they're becoming cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. I need to sell myself in some ways. I need to become the person that you hire, because when you hire me, I do photos and I will do video potentially. Oh, and I will do audio. I was mostly focused on photos and audio. For me, photos and audio equal two great mediums. If you can write a picture caption around a photo, that's a story. The photo's a story on its own. And then the audio is standalone in so many ways as well. But combine the two and you've got a bonus medium. You've got video. So I found that I could get value out of showing people how to do this. So initially, my diversifying into multimedia came about by teaching photography groups. And I've got to give, you know, a big mention to the Red Eye Photography Network, who back in, I can't remember if it's 2005 or 6, invited me to do a talk. And I was like, what, you want me to talk in front of people? And I've been in a band and, you know, I'd performed and stuff, but I didn't think that I could actually share knowledge in a way where people would actually understand and take something away. So I was stood in front of a lot of photographers and they were like, show us, teach us this witchcraft. How do you make photos into video? How do you do these slideshow things? And I did. And I got a lot of speaking engagements as a result. And for me, my biography says talking, teaching and documenting. And in many ways, it's in that order. I get to document more for myself than I do for clients, because when I do a documenting job for clients, it tends to be something that's worked out over a time and is a relatively big thing. I can't remember exactly how many years ago, but I had a kind of secret website in the town of Rugby. I was living in Rugby and I bought drugby.co.uk because everybody called it Drugby because of the huge drug issues it had. And I wanted to document these because there wasn't Talk to Frank back then. There wasn't anywhere you could go online and actually get real people's stories about how drugs were affecting their lives. So I kind of hid myself behind this forum, this website. And I realised that some of the stories out there from my local town were fascinating. And I got together with an artist friend of mine who, I'd kind of got all of the experimenting with these kind of things out of the way when I was travelling, but I was coming into contact with more and more people who hadn't, and they were stuck in ruts. One friend of mine was immensely, immensely talented artist, and used drugs for a tool, and I would never work with him when I knew that he was using drugs, and then did when he wasn't. And we decided to do a documentary together, and this was going to be the definitive story of Rugby Town and its historical connection with drugs being, excuse the pun, kind of the main line to the north and everything stopping there at some point. And fortunately, you know, we'd just set up the initial intro and got a couple of stories down, and he died of an overdose, a freak kind of night where he was out celebrating in a town where he didn't know anybody, found himself in a hostel because there was nowhere else to stay, and overdosed and died. And so I kind of took it upon myself, not being a filmmaker, to start podcasting and collecting stories, because I wish in many ways that I'd recorded more of him and others that I'd come into contact with and were no longer here. And that kind of led to me uploading a podcast initially when it was your manual XML file, and not as easy as some of the apps we've got now. And I found that a lot of people that I couldn't see were listening and connecting around the world, and I was getting emails from primarily Japan. A lot of people in Japan really into the podcasting scene, and then America, and then finally closer to home, the UK. And it kind of blew me away that I could collect these stories in what felt like a very personal act and then stick them on a server somewhere online, make a very slight attempt in the hope people will find them. And they did, but they were sharing them, and they were sharing them and downloading them. There was one guy who would download my podcasts onto CDs and deliver them to his local blind community, because he said the way that I started my podcast was I was painting a picture and setting a scene, and when you've got that, you can kind of see where the conversation and or the story is going. I'm in an enviable position, I guess, because I choose a lot of what I do right now, and I'm in my dream job, and many of the assignments I do are already my dream assignments. But I do have fleeting moments when I think, wouldn't it be great if? And I think I'd like to travel to an area of the world, a wilderness, if there is still such a place, and come into contact with people who have very little idea about the outside world, in the hope that I can glean what their perceptions are of what's important in life, outside of all the distractions that we have in the Western world, outside of all the technology that we saturate ourselves with. So I think it would be, you know, maybe visiting some tribe in deepest, darkest Borneo. It would also give everybody who was sending me there a break from the incessant tweeting and jibber-jabbering that I tend to do online. I've got a thing for jungles. I've had some amazing times in jungles, but most of that time has been selfish trekking through with all the right gear and not really learning from the people who know that place better than anything else. And we're losing this. We're losing so many areas of the world and so many stories. Stories which I would have a great difficulty in capturing, but I'd be sure, should I travel to this place, that I would take the equipment so that the most switched on in the tribe could capture as much as possible. This, you know, when we kill people, we kill stories. When we let civilizations get taken over by Western culture, and I say that sometimes everybody will say people are happier for that, but I think we're losing what makes us such an incredible, diverse species. I found a recording which I think, if you Google Theodore Podolsky or something like that, it would probably come up on one of my blogs. But it was a tape I didn't know I had or forgotten I had, and it was of me chatting to my granddad, trying to get him to sing a song for me. And it's kind of strange, because my gran obviously got jealous that we had a recorder, a crappy cassette tape recorder stuck under him, and he was singing these songs. He's Ukrainian, and he was obviously very, very moved, because it was the first time he'd recited these songs in 50-odd years, 60 years maybe. And then my gran comes in asking us what we want to eat, just so that she could stop the recording. And the interaction, there's my granddad, my grandmother, my younger brother, and me. And stumbling upon this, which I now think is possibly the only recording I've got of his voice, is just, you can't put a price on that. It's absolutely golden, because you can capture emotion in a photograph, but how real is that out of context? Because you hold a camera up and so many people are aware of it quite a lot of the time. But just the quiver in his voice, and so much of the context is still yet to be discovered, because he's singing another language. And I say, what's that about? And he would try and explain. But what I really need to do is find out exactly what it's about, why he would have been singing it, and where he was, which I can still do by getting into that audio. So that's what really blows my mind about audio.